Guardian Unlimited.
Hello again, I'm Ben Green, and I produce the Science Weekly podcast on Guardian Unlimited, which, in my humble opinion anyway, was pretty splendid this week. So, thanks for downloading this edition of Science Extra. Clearly, you're like me, and the kind of person that finds the idea of herrings farting and ducks engaging in homosexual necrophilia rather, well, rather interesting. So, here's our extended interview with Mark Abrahams about all that and much, much more. If you want to comment on anything that Mark has to say or this year's Ig Nobel Awards, why not send us an email to science@guardian.co.uk or post a comment on our blog at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts. And if you want to listen to a more serious interview about string theory, go and download this week's other Science Extra podcast. But that's enough from me. Over now to James Randerson with more.
Well, first of all, tell us a bit about the Ig Nobels. What are they?
They're prizes. And we give them out every year. Their prize is given for something unusual, though. I think they are, or maybe the only prizes that are not given for the very best of something or for the very worst. Almost everything in the world goes for an extreme. That stuff's irrelevant for the Ig Nobels. An Ig Nobel Prize honors something that has this quality. It first makes people laugh and then makes them think. That's it, just that one criterion.
Yeah, I think the best way to find out about the Ig Nobels is to have some examples. So first of all, can anyone out there guess what this is? Mark, perhaps you could enlighten us.
Okay, that was the noise of a herring. It was a noise that was first recognized by scientists not all that long ago. And it was recognized by two different groups of scientists in different parts of the world who didn't at the time realize that this discovery was happening simultaneously. One group was in Canada. The group itself is partly based in Scotland as well. The other group was in Sweden. And in both cases, they were recording sounds underwater. In the second case, they knew they were recording sounds made by herrings. They didn't know what this was when they first heard it. It was a sound that puzzled them. And then they went back and looked at films, which they also were taking, and they realized when the sounds were occurring, and at that point concluded that these are the sounds of herrings farting.
So did they see telltale streams of bubbles at the crucial moment?
Yes. What else do you expect they'd see?
Fantastic. And
that was the second group. The first group, which had done really their work, their discovery a few years earlier, was in Sweden, and it's a somewhat different story. They did not set out to record the sounds of fish. They were trying to do something very different. They were given a grant, I believe, by the Swedish Navy. The Swedish Navy had something that they were trying to get done, and this was about 20 years ago. And at that time, the Swedish Navy was very concerned with submarines that perhaps were being sent in to Stockholm Harbor by the Soviet Union. And they were recording sounds underwater. They heard this peculiar sound, which you've now heard, and thought, aha, submarines, at last we have evidence. But if you're a small country located next to the very large and well-armed Soviet Union, if you're going to go in public and make a statement like that, you want to check. So they consulted a couple of the best fish biologists they could get a hold of, had them listen to this, and these fish biologists told them, no, that's not submarines, that's herrings. And at that point, those biologists looked into it more and figured out exactly what it was the herrings were doing.
Wow, so fish
flatulence. But that's not the end of the story either.
Oh, really?
The Canadian-Scottish team concluded that probably what's going on with these things, probably underlying it is communications, that this is how herrings talk to other herrings.
Wow, so how fish flatulence nearly caused a major diplomatic incident.
And yet ended up by saving
indeed
the day and keeping an incident from happening.
Yeah, thank goodness for fish biologists. Okay, you've got another example of it for us also from the natural world.
We have no end of such examples.
I'm sure. Tell us about what ducks get up to.
This is, we don't know that it's all ducks, but we gave the Ig Nobel Biology Prize a few years ago to Kees Mulliker. Kees is a scientist in Rotterdam in the Netherlands, and one day he observed something, he noticed something. And being a good scientist, he went and got his notebook and a camera, and he documented this. He works in a building that's fairly new. The outside of it is all glass, and it's not unusual for birds to fly into the side of the building. They got used to the sound, the typical sound there, but one day he heard a really unusual and loud bang, and he rushed to the window, and he saw that a mallard duck had very obviously flown at very high speed into the building, smacked into it, and died. He saw the carcass sitting there below him. While he was watching, he saw a second mallard flying in at high speed, but the second mallard duck didn't hit the building. Instead, it landed on the ground next to the first one and began engaging in activity, which Kees documented. And this resulted, eventually, when he published it, in the world's first scientifically documented case of homosexual necrophilia in the mallard duck.
Wow.
There's more detail if you'd like it.
Carry on, please.
Since you ask. Kees sat there for quite a while documenting this, and the incident lasted 75 minutes. The reason it lasted only 75 minutes was it was approaching the end of the workday. Kees was getting hungry. He wanted to go home for dinner, so he went outside and broke it up and collected the dead one, which he, at a later time, did an autopsy on. That's how he knows that they were both males. And that's the story of the first documented case of homosexual necrophilia in the mallard duck in Rotterdam, the Netherlands.
Well, so how do you go about deciding who the winners are?
It's not easy. It really isn't easy.
Is it just you, or is there some kind of panel?
There's a large shadowy group that does this, the Ig Nobel Board of Governors. We've been doing this since 1991, and keep in mind that we give 10 prizes every year. We're always looking for things, but most of the nominations come in from other places. Anybody can send in a nomination, and every year we get somewhere in the range of 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 new nominations. And things stay in the pool, since we can only give 10, and there are far more things in the world that deserve Ig Nobel Prizes. The pool we have to choose those 10 from every year is growing and growing. It's enormous. So even just on a numerical basis, it's not an easy thing to do. And there are so many things. So we sort through these things. The group, we have meetings in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where we're based, and we also do a lot of the work by telephone, by email, other ways with the other people involved who are scattered around the world. We managed to narrow it down. We have a policy that in most cases, when we've selected somebody or some team to win an Ig Nobel Prize, we'll get in touch with them very quietly beforehand and explain it to them and give them the opportunity to say no if they want to. But very few people ever turn it down.
You're in town at the moment with a kind of roadshow of Ig Nobel extravaganza. Where are you going to be this week?
All over the place. It's National Science and Engineering Week in the UK. And this year, for the fifth consecutive year, we're doing a bunch of live events, shows really, around the country. So tonight, there is a show in Bristol. Tuesday night in London at the Guardian Newsroom. Wednesday night in Portsmouth. Thursday night back in London at Imperial College, and then Saturday afternoon in Cambridge.
And how can people go about getting tickets?
Tickets are free in all these cases. Some of the shows are completely booked up. If you go online to our website, improbable.com, or also to the Guardian website, I think there's information about how to get in touch. At a few of the shows, there may be a couple of tickets that free up at the last moment if people don't show up for their tickets. I don't know that that'll happen, but it, you know, with any kind of event, it's worth doing that.
And just finally, I have to ask you about, because this one fits into our great tea debate that's ongoing. Tell us about what the British Standards Institution had to say about a cup of tea.
Pretty much every year, one of the prizes we give is the Ig Nobel Literature Prize. One year, the Ig Nobel Literature Prize was awarded to the British Standards Institution. They got the Literature Prize because the British Standards Institution publishes a 6-page specification for the proper way to make a cup of tea.
That's attention to detail. That's what we like to see in this pod.
And they'll charge you a lot of money if you want to get a copy of that standard.
Oh, really? Oh, how disappointing. What's the...
But you always knew that that knowledge is valuable.
How on earth do you fit that much information? I mean, how can you say that much about making a cup of tea?
British Standards Institution sets standards for almost anything you can think of, manufacturers, processes, all sorts of things. And this is for the industry that buys and sells tea. So they wanted to have some standardized way of assessing what is a cup of tea so they can compare a cup of this type of tea versus a cup of that type of tea and compare that with cups of tea that have been brewed in previous years in previous places, thus the British standard cup of tea.
Well, just for the record, what is the Mark Abrams standard cup of tea?
I'm American, remember, so I'm terribly ignorant about how to do these things properly. I just take a tea bag and dunk it into some hot water.
And dunking, as in biscuit, donuts, any of that?
Well, here you're probably very slyly alluding to another prize that we gave a number of years ago to Len Fisher from Bristol University, who won the Ig Nobel Physics Prize for calculating the optimal way to dunk a biscuit.
We've got to know, what is the optimal way?
I'm not sure we have the time, and I also am not quite sure I remember the details. I would hate to get it wrong, but there is an optimal way, at least according to Len Fisher's calculations, and not just calculations, he did some experiments.
Well, we should link to that on the blog. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
Guardian Unlimited.